This is the fourth sermon in a series, and many of you have been here for all of them, but some of you haven't. So I'll do a really quick summary. We're in Luke 15, and in Luke 15, we have these three parables at the beginning of the chapter there it starts, but these parables that have to do with lost and lost being found. So we'll read through it quickly and just have a couple comments, and then we'll get to today's sermon. We start in verse 1. It says, all the tax collectors and sinners were coming near to hear him and to listen to him. Jesus, of course, is talking about. Both the Pharisees and the scribes began to grumble, saying, this man receives sinners and eats with them. So he told them this parable. And then we get into one. But the point, I think it's reasonable to assume it's not just the one parable, but the way that Luke put them together, all of these parables have to do with the same subject. And that is the way the scribes and the Pharisees were critical of Jesus' ministry, because Jesus saw himself as a rescuer, as a savior, and so the people that are well didn't need a doctor, but the people that were sick needed a doctor. And the religious leaders, especially the Pharisees, who were concerned about purity, and that's why I have that little slide there, caution radiation, they were concerned about purity and what they touched and what they didn't touch and who they were with and who they weren't going to be with and all that kind of thing. Jesus was constantly being criticized for that in the Gospels. So you realize it had to be an ongoing thing. And Luke decides to take a chapter here and deal with that with the three of the parables that Jesus gave, perhaps not at the same time, but Luke puts them in the same chapter because they all make the same point, or at least some of the same points. So the Pharisees were just very particular about who, people that were not like them. And we're all like that. That's human nature, to somehow or another not like or discriminate against or whatever, people that are not like us. And Jesus was fighting that 2,000 years ago, so it's nothing new. Excuse me. So we go into verse 3 here. So Jesus told them a parable, and he said, what man among you has 100 sheep, lost one of them, doesn't leave the 99 in the open pasture and go after the one which is lost until he finds it? And when he found it, he lays it on his shoulders, rejoicing. And we talked about how shepherds were despised in that culture. The Pharisees, in particular, said you couldn't be a shepherd and keep to their purity rules and their laws. So it was an occupation that wasn't even allowed if you wanted to be a pious Pharisee. They were assumed to be robbers. They weren't allowed to testify in court. So, Jesus uses this type of a person as a good example. And as a way of kind of like just thumbing his nose at the Pharisees. And when he comes back home, he says he calls together his friends and his neighbors, saying to them, rejoice with me, for I found my sheep which is lost. And I tell you, in the same way, there will be more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous people who need no repentance. So the meaning's pretty obvious. It's right there. And sometimes the meanings of the parables are given. What we'll find out today is that we have a parable where the meaning is not given, so we have to figure it out. And people have come to all different types of conclusions. I can't say that one's wrong necessarily and one's right, but I'll have my own opinion and present it. And you realize that when it's not explicit, when Jesus doesn't say, this is why I'm saying this, man, you got to think a little bit. We talked a little bit about Luke, the different themes that Luke seems to be concerned about. He talks about wealth quite a bit and what's done with it. He talks about prayer and how it works. He talks about the leadership of the religious institutions of his day, and usually that's in a negative sense. He speaks, like in Luke 15, of the concern that Jesus had for the lost. He also talks about the role of women, more so than the other Gospels. And we spent a little bit of time in one of the sermons talking about that, how Luke pays attention to that. We mentioned a little bit about what it meant to lay, put a sheep up on your shoulders, and as you all have told us, it's not an easy thing. The sheep aren't just like, you can't throw them around. They got some weight. And it's interesting that in the early church, that this kind of an image was an image that was used, I won't say more often than the cross, but you see this instead of the cross a lot of times. And Jesus is portrayed as seeking out the lost, seeking out, just as in the parable, he's seeking out this lost sheep. So Jesus carries the sheep. He's a rescuer. And he works at it. And, we are his workmanship, and we talked about all that. It's a how much more parable, as many of the parables are. You know, if even a shepherd that you despise will do this, how much more will God do something that's good? So there are a lot of how much more parables in the Gospels, and this is one of them. Then we talked about the lost coin when we moved on to the next parable, which starts in verse 8. It says, what woman, if she has 10 silver coins and loses one coin, doesn't light a lamp and sweep the house and search carefully till she finds it? And when she's found it, she calls together her friends and neighbors, saying, rejoice with me, for I have found my coin which I lost. In the same way, I tell you, there's joy in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents. Once again, we have the meaning right here. It's right in the parable. This is why Jesus told it. This particular coin was apparently about a day's wages, so it would be, you know, a lot of dollars in today's money. It's not just an insignificant quarter that you happen to have dropped. It was a significant amount of money at that time. And we, again, are appealing to a woman's point of view, as Jesus did very often in his teaching. He didn't neglect the women. He had women disciples, as I mentioned before. That was not normal in his time. There are many examples of that. We went through them. We talked about the houses, at least in Capernaum, that they've excavated, found out they have these basalt rocks as floors sometimes. And it would be easy for a coin to get caught in between the cracks in the floors, although the coin wouldn't be shiny like this one and easy to find. So the windows were all small, and they usually were up high. I'm not sure what the reason is for that. I'm not an archaeologist. Maybe it had to do with animals sticking their noses in. I don't really know, or rain or whatever it is. But the windows were up high, and they're usually like slits. So there wasn't a lot of light on the floor. Even in the daytime, you might have to light a lamp, or at least in early morning or late evening, you'd have to light a lamp in order to look for anything. And that's the analogy here. And of course, it shows again the effort that the woman is willing to put forth to get the coin, showing that, you know, in the analogy, of course, that Jesus, as his job as a savior, as a rescuer, is willing to put forth effort to make that happen. He carries the sheep, he sweeps, he lights the lamp. There's some work involved in rescuing what's lost. And we talked a little bit about that, you know, do we have the mind of God on that? Because these two parables show that God cares about those that are lost. And he doesn't just care about those he's found, as Jesus said, you know, the ones who are sick are the ones that need the doctor. So we can take that home. Then we talked about a parable that I called the two lost sons rather than the prodigal son. You could say, well, it's called the prodigal son. Why not? And I said, well, you know, when you look at the parable, it says a man had two sons. So it's about two of them, at least at the beginning. The younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the share of the estate that falls to me. And he divided his wealth between them. So you think the focus is going to be about the two sons, but it's actually more than that even, because you have three main actors. You have the father and you have two sons. So there's a lot going on there, and to call it the parable of the prodigal son doesn't do it justice. It doesn't, because as we'll see today, the most verses in the parable don't have to do with the younger son at all. There's more about the father and the older son. There's three main characters, of course, and the main point of the parable is not about being a wasteful young man and blowing your inheritance. That sets the story up, but it's not the main point of the parable at all. And if we just focus on the younger son, we miss the majority of the action, and we miss really the second. It's more than just half. It's the majority of the parable. This guy here that I recommended his book for, Klein Snodgrass, he calls it the compassionate father and his two lost sons. I think that's a great title. It's just too long. So let's continue. In verse 1, and we said, a man had two sons, and we covered we set this up last time I was here a few weeks ago. Had two sons, the younger of whom said to his father, give me the share of the estate that falls to me. And he divided his wealth between them. And I ask, what's implied here? Well, this, and we talked about it. You chimed in. Dishonor. And also that in the Middle Eastern culture, to ask for your money before your father's dying or dead or whatever is in a sense a death wish. So I wish you were dead. I want the money now. So it's just a dishonorable thing all around. And even the Romans and the Greeks, but especially the Romans, would say this. Like, this is not something that's just unique to Judaism. The Romans, you could read Roman poets and Roman authors, and they say the same kind of thing. This is just extremely disrespectful in the whole cultural Middle East, whether you're Greek or Roman or Jewish. And it says that he divided his wealth between them. Now, we talked about how really, you know, it's enough to stretch your brain a little bit to think that there's this kid that, or maybe not a kid, he's probably in his 40s, his father's already old, but he's you know, he's older. It's a story, so we don't know exactly. But he could be an older son. But the point is that he asks, and that's kind of strange. What's even stranger is that the father would say yes. You know, most people hearing this story would think there's no way the father's going to give in and give it to him. The father's going to kick him out of the house or reprimand him or, you know, whatever. But it's the way the story, again, it's, we're setting the story up. Jesus is setting it up to make some points, right? The way he sets it up is that the father actually gives in and distributes some of the wealth. Probably not the land, that wouldn't make sense, but he distributes some of the money that would be coming to his younger son. And then it says, not many days later, the younger son gathered everything together and went on a journey into a distant country, and there he squandered his estate, all right, with loose living. So there's the prodigal part, the wasteful part, where we get the name. And he went somewhere with a whole bunch of other Europeans, according to this painting here, and wasted his money. There's a lot of great paintings. I got a few more of them in here later that were Rembrandt and others in the 1600s that of this particular, I think Rembrandt was 1600, I forget, but I think I have it written down. But there's a lot of European paintings of this, and they paint it with Europeans. They don't even try to make them look like people from the Middle East. So we talked about the Middle Eastern context of all this and the way Jesus' audience. And we're not in that audience, and we don't know exactly what those people were thinking, but what was the culture that they lived in? And when we looked at that, you know, one of the things is that we as Americans, or we as in the 21st century, we're very individualistic, and we always have been in our country. We think we can do anything. We've accomplished a lot because we have that independent spirit, and that's wonderful. But it wasn't that way then, and it's still not that way so much in the Middle East. As you see, you know, in Afghanistan this week, the Afghans, they don't want to fight. That's a different culture. We think that we're going to give them billions and billions of dollars and lots of arms, and that they're going to fight for their country. And then we leave, and they say, "No, we're not doing that." So we don't, as Americans, a lot of times we don't understand the way other people think and the way their culture is. Well, it was no different back then. The culture is very, very different from ours. And they didn't think as individuals. And for the son to say, "I want my money and I want to do what I want to do," that was very unusual, and it was looked down on. So anybody that's hearing the story would say, "Well, that's odd. That's odd. I'd never do that." What you depended on was your family status in the village or in the area, in the region, and the honor of your family, the honor of your father, your grandfather, the ones that are alive, or the ones that have already gone on. You had this interdependence between family members and extended family members, aunts, uncles, and so on. And you had to do that because it wasn't easy for people to survive on their own. It was just a different world than what we have. And in the villages, you kind of, you know, that's your village. That's, you know, not too many people got out of town. That's where everything was. And you had a certain honor among the people, a certain reputation. And if you were blessed, you were expected to share that blessing with other people in the village. And that was, and to conform with the norms. Well, disadvantage, you might think, is that everybody knows everybody's business. That's just the way it is. But they were interdependent. Okay, so that's just a quick background. That's an awful lot of information in a short amount of time. But we have to remember when we read these parables that it was a different world then. And so the people that are hearing those parables don't hear them the way we do. Now we go to verse 14. Now, when he had spent everything, a severe famine occurred in that country. And that was, you know, they had famines then, just like we have famines now. And they didn't have long supply lines from other countries or whatever, like we do now, that can help people out in their times of need. So a lot of times just had to migrate, as Abraham did back in, this, you know, you read in Genesis, right? They had a famine. He had to go down to Egypt where there was food. So, because the Nile would always flood even during a famine. So it says that he went and hired himself to one of the citizens of that country because he just couldn't afford to eat anymore. And they sent him out in the field to feed swine. Of course, this is a story that Jesus is making up. So what he's saying here is that not only did the kid have to start working for a living after he had blown his inheritance, but he had a job that was about as distasteful as you could get for a Jewish man. It's the bottom of the barrel of all the things you could possibly be forced to do. So that's what we're doing. Jesus is drawing this picture of somebody in very, very dire straits in some of the most stark terms that you could give to a Jewish audience. So he hired himself out. He's feeding the pigs, and he would have gladly filled his stomach with the pods that the swine were eating, and no one was giving anything to him. So he would have eaten the pig food. That's how bad it was. And then it says in verse 17, then he came to his senses. And we don't know exactly what that means. Some people say, well, that means he repented. Well, it doesn't say that. It just says he came to his senses. Some of us have had children, right? And in some cases, those children don't come to their senses until later than we wish they would. You know, because we want to live as children. We want to have everything given to us or whatever it is. And sometimes it takes being married or having kids or having, you know, the need to go get a serious job or whatever to where, you know, a young person comes to his senses. Well, this person, however young he was, and again, it's a story, he came to his senses. He came to realize, hey, you know, this isn't working out. I better do something else. And he says, how many of my father's hired men have more than enough bread, but I'm dying here with hunger? I will get up and go to my father. And I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven. Now, he hasn't done this yet. He's rehearsing with his mind. He's got a lot of time to think out there watching the pigs. And he says, I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven, and in your sight I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me as one of your hired men. So he was going back not to ask for his former position, but to just to go to work. He's willing to become a servant. He didn't have that attitude before, but now he does. So he got up and came to his father, and that's where we stopped last time. And I said that one son is now looking to be found. And I have to apologize for those of you who were here. I didn't give you any takeaways. I've been advised before that, look, when you give a sermon and you have a two-part sermon, you got to give takeaways in the first part. You can't just tell them to wait until next time. They might not be there, whatever. You have to make it worthwhile. And I didn't do that in one sense, for sure. And Dan bailed me out a little bit with the closing prayer, and I thank him for that. But, you know, I didn't give you anything then. So I apologize for that, but we're going to make up for it now. And there are things to take from this, too, from the first part of it. One is that the son did come to his senses, and he decided he was going to go to his father. It's interesting that it's worded that way. It says he got up and came to his father. But while he was in, you know, I didn't read all of verse 20 last time, so we're now starting the rest of verse 20. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion for him and ran and embraced him and kissed him. There's a lot here. Now I'm going to read the entire rest of the parable, and then we'll go back and dissect it a little bit. The son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. So he says exactly what he was planning to say. This is about half of Rembrandt's painting, The Return of the Prodigal Son. It was painted somewhere in the late 1660s. It's in a museum in Russia in St. Petersburg. You'll see the whole picture later. But the father said to his slaves, quickly, bring out the best robe and put it on him and put a ring on his hand and sandals on his feet and bring the fattened calf and kill it and let us eat and celebrate, for the son of mine was dead, and has come to life again. He was lost and has been found. And they began to celebrate. This is another old painting from the late 1600s. And I wrote down who painted it. Now I forgot his name, but it's late. I have it later, so you'll see it. This is again an excerpt from it. Now the older son was in the field. And when he came and approached the house, he heard music and dancing, and he summoned one of the servants and began inquiring as to what these things could be. And he said to him, now, I'm sorry, I have a picture here of the servant's a woman, but it's a man in the story. Could have been either way. he said to him, your brother has come, and your father has killed the fattened calf, because he's received him back safe and sound. But he became angry, and he wasn't willing to go in. And his father came out and began pleading with him. But he answered and said to his father, look, for so many years I've been serving you, and I've never neglected a command of yours, and you haven't even given me a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours came, who has devoured your wealth with prostitutes. You killed the fattened calf for him, and you said to him, 'Son, you've always been with me.'" This is what the father's saying. "You've always been with me, and all that is mine is yours. But we had to celebrate and rejoice, for this brother of yours was dead, and he has begun to live. And he was lost, and he's been found." So it's a wonderful story. It's famous. It's been interpreted for 2,000 years in probably, I was going to say 2,000 different ways. That's not true, but in many, many different ways. Because that's the end of the parable there. And he doesn't say, "Well, he said this because blah, blah, blah," like he did with the other two. So we get to interpret it ourselves, and we come up with a lot of answers. And maybe sometimes, and I got to give credit to Snodgrass for this, he makes the point over and over again in the book with a lot of parables, but especially this one, that we need to be careful not to try to get more out of it than what's in it. And sometimes we can do that. We can try to dig so deep. I'm not saying you might do that, but when you read the books on the parables, sometimes they're looking for all kinds of little things, as if Jesus is trying to make a point with every single word he says, rather than just paint a picture and tell a story. I happen to personally believe that he's painting a picture and telling a story, and then we don't need to look at every single little tiny word and say, that is this, and this is that, and everything. You know, I don't think he was thinking in that sense. He's painting a picture to make a point. And as I've mentioned before, each parable doesn't try to cover everything completely. It makes one point about one subject, usually, just one. And that, you know, if you want to know another point, you got to listen to another parable, another story. So we have these lost two sons. There's all these interpretations that have come up over the years. Some of them by the church fathers. You know, is it Gentile Christians as opposed to Jewish Christians? And the one son stands for some and the other son stands for the others. Is it the story of Israel? As one scholar that I really like, I don't always agree with him, but I really like him. He says almost every parable for him is some kind of a story about Israel and Israel's history. There's a sociological commentary. When I was here last time, I read from this book that talked about how society was, and I was reading a little bit from that book to help educate us all about Middle Eastern society 2,000 years ago. But if you read the whole portion of that book that's talking about this parable, it goes into all these sociological implications, like Jesus is some kind of sociologist, and he's making these points about society and villages instead of, you know, I don't think he is, because, you know, it's a simple story, and he's making some simple points. I don't think you have to dig deep and think Jesus somehow had this ulterior motive way back in the back and hid it. I don't think that's the way it is. A lot of these interpretations, Judah and Ephraim, I didn't even look this one up. I just saw the headline. I don't know. You know, because there's two different, the Judah and then the northern 10 tribes, and how there was a conflict between them, and this parable somehow, they want to tie, a lot of interpreters want to tie this parable back into the Old Testament in certain ways. This is one of them, Judah and Ephraim, Egypt, certain things about Egypt, I'll mention that later. Repentance and restoration. I kind of like that one. That one seems to make sense, because that's you don't have to dig deep to find that one. It's just right out there in front. Pharisees, Sadducees, and Jesus? Well, yeah, I mean, that's how the chapter starts out. They were critical of him for mixing and mingling and eating with and whatever, sinners. And so we have three parables that involve sinners, or no, I shouldn't say sinners, but involve loss, because you can't call a coin a sinner or a sheep a sinner, but things that are lost, whether it's people or things, and God's interest in finding them, in rescuing them, through the work of Jesus, who is the rescuer, the Savior. Some of them find the Father and the Son, the Holy Spirit in here, and the three characters, the Father and the two sons, and the interpretations just go on and on and on. And even though there are all these interpretations, there's one thing that should stick out right away, and I don't know how to ask you a question and lead you into the answer I'm looking for. Can you spot a difference? Here we have a story about a father and two sons. We've already had a story about a shepherd and sheep, one sheep that was lost. We've already had a story about a woman and a coin that's lost. And now we have a story about a father and a son, or I'm saying two sons, that are lost. What's a big difference between the first two and this one?
Father didn't go out looking for him.
That's a big one. That's one. That's not the one I'm looking for, but that's in there. Definitely. The father wasn't, in this one, we'll talk about that a little later, but the father wasn't looking for him. I think he was looking in a sense, like it says he saw him afar off. It's as if he was just kind of at least looking out there just to see maybe if he'd come back. Yes?
I was going to say the first two involve objects and the third one involves persons.
Right. And that's the one I was looking for, too. Coin can't think. A sheep can't think too much, apparently. I don't know. You would know. Do they think much? I guess they can think some. But. So, you have two objects or things that are not so thinking. They're not sentient. In the third parable, we have a sentient being that is lost and makes certain choices and decisions. So that's different, just on the face of it. And so because that's different, we can learn some different things. So let's go back, and in the rest of the sermon, we'll just look at these verses from, what verse is it? Verse 20 on, and see what we can pick up, just without digging too awfully deep and trying to find out some of those other maybe offbeat interpretations. Well, what's right on the face of it, easy to pick up? The low branches. So he got up and came to his father, and while he was still a long way off, the father saw him and felt compassion for him and ran and embraced him and kissed him. Okay. It says he got up and came to his father. Why didn't it say he decided to go home? I don't know that I have an answer for that, but it could have just said he decided he was going to go back home. But it doesn't say that. That's not how Jesus said it. He didn't say come home. He said he decided to go to his father. So how would you interpret that? Does that mean anything to you? I don't really have a good answer here. I just wanted to know if it strikes you with anything.
Just saying simply going home doesn't show that what he felt he was up against going to his father, what he had done.
His father was the one that he had offended and he had to make up. Okay, yeah. Uh-huh. He didn't need to reconcile with home in that sense necessarily, but he did have to reconcile with his father. I think that's what I get out of it too. It's different, and Jesus set this one up in a different way to make some different points, because we don't have that inanimate coin or the not so smart sheep. We have a person that's actually making some choices and decisions. So there's an effort. The coin is not trying to get found. The sheep in the story is not trying to get found. This boy is, I would say boy, sorry, this young man or son, however old he is, at some point he decides he wants to be found again. So he's thinking, we have a thinking character here, which is good, I think. It's good for a lot of reasons. I mean, Luke is trying to make some points here, right? And you can brush off a coin or a sheep and think, well, what's that have to do with me? But here we have a story that involves people doing people things. And I think as you go through this, and you, not that you haven't been through it before, but I think as we go through this, you see there's an awful lot of me in here or here, in him or him or him, one of those three. We see ourselves in the story, and that's why we can learn things that we might not learn from a story about a coin or a sheep. You read all the interpretations. I don't read them all. I got a lot of books. And they argue about the whether the son's repentant or not repentant. Could be he's just hungry, right? Could be he just doesn't have any shoes anymore. His father has to get sandals for him, it says later on. You can say one way or the other. The point is he decides he wants to go home. But from what he said he planned to say and what he said, I agree with you that he's seeking reconciliation. He's actually looking for it, as the coin can't do. And to help the story work that way, as Jim said, Jesus doesn't paint a picture of the father actively looking for the son. It's more like he's waiting for him to come back. He does notice him. He sees him out there. And he responds. But it's not like he's out there searching like the guy was searching for the one sheep that was lost. So it's making some different points, this particular parable. It says, while he was still a long way off. So I'm suggesting that if you're a long way off, then the father at least once in a while is looking out there, I wonder if he'll come home. It's not like he's just written him off. He's not out there searching for him, letting the kid, the son, learn a few things on his own. But he is keeping an eye out, apparently, because it says, again, it's a made-up story, but Jesus is framing it in a way that it looks like the father's at least looking out there to see. And so the father desired the reconciliation, even if he wasn't actively seeking it and out there, searching far and wide. What good would it have done for him to search far and wide? Because here, again, we have a sentient being that has decided to leave his father. So what's the point of, what would it be the point of going and finding him when he's decided to leave? So, you can see that. That makes sense.
He might have rebelled more.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a story, but we're dealing with human nature here, not a coin. So there's a lot of extra little things we can look for and point out because we have a thinking being here. But it says the father saw him and felt compassion for him. So there's still some feelings. He hadn't written him off. And he ran and embraced him and kissed him. So his father welcomed him. His father didn't say, "Ah, boy, you owe me now." You know, the father didn't do any of the things that I would tend to do. So I got some things to learn here. Too late now. I got grandchildren now. One of whom comes in, I was telling Sandy, he comes in this morning working on a sermon. "What are you doing?" "I'm working on a sermon." And by now he knows the routine. He's like, he leaves and doesn't say anything. Just hopes I do well. But, he wanted my time, and I didn't have time. So, got to make time. Anyway, his father welcomed him. And notice, and this is not me either. Not the way I tend to be. He welcomed him before hearing anything the son had to say. He ran out and embraced him and felt compassion for him. Without waiting for the "I'm sorry, Dad." Right? So that's interesting, the way Jesus again paints it, because I can't imagine there weren't people in his audience just like me that are thinking, this guy, he's owed a big apology. And Jesus tells the story like, the father welcomes him, greets him, kisses him, and before the son even has a chance to say anything. So something we can learn there too. In the Middle East, do old, fairly old fathers run? No. So this shows something too. Although, as Jim says, he's not out looking for his son. When he sees him, he has compassion and he runs. Everybody that's hearing this story going, "What? He running? They don't run." So what Jesus is painting a picture here that's making people think. And that's the way I'm trying to present it, so we can think about it. People have to think, because the people in the story are not acting like people in the story. All of them, I should put it. They're not always acting as the hearers of this parable would expect. So Jesus is making people think. What would I do? How would I respond? And that's what makes the parable so interesting, because you get to the end, he doesn't tell you what to think. You got to figure it out. So the son said to him, just as he said he was going to say, "Father, I've sinned against heaven and in your sight." What is a sin? Or what are his sins? I don't think there's, again, a right and a wrong answer here. I mean, is nothing wrong? He's just sorry because he's hungry and his shoes wore out? What sins has he, that you think that maybe he's committed? You're sitting there, Jesus telling his story, and the son says, "I've sinned against heaven and in your sight." What are you thinking? What sins?
Vanity.
Vanity, okay.
Greed.
He wanted his money before it was due him. Dishonored his father and his whole family. So that's a bunch of commands, if you want to put it that way. He dishonored father. He requested his money in the first place, so that's greedy. He dishonored his father by not being around to help. I mean, it's part of the duty of sons to take care of their father. Maybe the firstborn son. But he took the money. What if his father got sick the next day? Well, he's got the money and he's out of town and he's not even going to know about it. So he's dishonoring his family that way. Selfishness, covetousness, greed, as Dan says. Anything else before we move from this? I mean, it could be any number of things. The son came to his senses, and he realized that he had dishonored in ways broken commandments. He says, "I'm no longer worthy to be called your son." Now, if we look at this in a spiritual way, are we ever worthy, in a sense, are we ever worthy to be called God's son or daughter? Huh? We are, because because of his grace, he made it that way. So this is a spiritual truism here. He's not father, but how does the father feel about this? Does the father say, "Well, you're right, you aren't worthy. You really messed up, and you got to pay"? Does he act that way? He doesn't act that way. You know, we'll read as we go on. This guy's nothing like me. He's very gracious. All right, so we continue reading. This is this picture, that the picture I showed you before, just part of this, is Luca Giordano. It's somewhere between 1680 and 1685. I assume he's Italian. This painting is in England somewhere. And if you look at the record, I don't understand. I don't know how English things work, but they have people there that are somebody, somehow they're related to kings and queens and whatever, and they're dukes and earls. This is one of those kind of guys. And this picture is in a museum, and it was part of the settlement in lieu of taxes. So I guess, you know, when you die and you owe a whole bunch of money, you can give paintings and stuff and get out of some of that. Your family can. So we can't do that here, I don't guess. Maybe we don't, because we don't have enough paintings. I don't know. The father said to his slaves, "Quickly, bring out the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and sandals on his feet, and bring the fattened calf. Kill it and let us eat and celebrate, for this son of mine was dead and has come to life again, and he was lost and has been found." And they began to celebrate. It says, put the best robe on him and a ring. This is where some of the people that interpret the parable say, well, the ring is kind of like Joseph's ring in Egypt, and the Pharaoh gave him authority, and the robe is the, you know, trying to look for meaning in every little detail. I doubt it. I think it's, you know, Jesus painting a picture of what the Father was willing to do for the Son when he was destitute. It's a story. It's not a theological treatise. It's not trying to, you know, I don't think, have some kind of a serious point about every word that's used. It's a story, painting a picture so that we can learn from the picture. It's just a description of how the Son was welcomed. And it says, for this son of mine was dead and has come to life again, and he's lost and he's been found. I'm not great on grammar. That's passive, right? He was dead and he has come to life again. He was lost, and so, I don't know. It's worded in a way as if the son didn't have anything to do with it. Does that make sense? It's like he was dead. He's come to life. It's not like he did anything. He came to life. And he was lost and he has been found. Now, what actually happened was the son decided to go back home and go to his father. But the way the father phrases it here, for whatever that's worth, is these things happened to his son. The son didn't actively make it happen. Why is it that way? I don't know the answer to that. This is just me thinking. I didn't get this out of a book. But it seems to me that the focus of the parable here and the focus of the father is on the fact that he's found, not the fact that he might have come to his senses or he might have, you know, decided to make the trip home. So in a sense, we've got kind of like the coin and kind of like the sheep. Even though the son is thinking and has done certain things, in a way, he's no different than the sheep and the coin. He was lost and now he's been found. So I think that's on purpose. Whether Jesus exactly referred, I didn't spell referred right, and whether Jesus said it exactly that way or Luke is phrasing it that way to fit with the other two parables, I don't know. But I think it's kind of important in a way to show that when this happens, when a sinner is found, it has everything to do with God and not so much to do with the person. I mean, it's good that people can seek God, and I'm not putting that down or saying it's impossible. But according to this parable anyway, it's kind of like, you know, that person's lost, and Jesus is going to find him. He's the rescuer. He's the Savior. And that's the way Jesus approached it in his ministry too. And it says they began to celebrate. So the theme is of celebration, and that's not new either. You know, they found a sheep and decided to have a party. The woman found her coin, decided to have a party. So we take that theme and we bring it into the parable of the two sons here. We're going to celebrate because whatever it was that was lost is now found. And that's important and that's significant. And that seems to me to be one of the main points of this whole series of parables. You know, that in heaven there's rejoicing when sinners are saved. And that's the mind of the Father. And I'm preempting my conclusions here, but it says right there in the first couple of verses in this chapter 15 that the reason Jesus gave some of the parables, if not all three of them, was because of the way the Pharisees viewed him and mixing and mingling with these people who needed to be rescued. And Jesus recognized that he can't rescue them if he can't build a relationship first. So you got to build a relationship with a sinner first before they're going to listen to what you have to say or follow your example. The Pharisees didn't see it that way. So no, we need to keep separate. That's the example we need to set, that we're pure and different. You can't touch you. And Jesus didn't look at it that way. So it says, the older son was in the field, and he came and approached the house, and he heard the music and dancing, so they started to party without him, and summoned one of the servants and began inquiring, and the servant told him, your brother's come, and your father's killed the fattened calf because he has received him back safe and sound. So the son was in the field. Now this is me, and it might be some of you. Are any of you that responsible firstborn that just kind of wears it as a burden and a badge at the same time? You understand? Maybe none of your firstborn, you don't know that. Well, some of you. But it's like, you know, I got one brother, so you know, it was like I had to be the responsible one. But it's typical. It's a typical firstborn behavior. And so Jesus knows that, and he's telling the story, and everybody can say, yeah, that's the way the firstborn are. He's out in the field. That's where he's supposed to be. That's his job. The son's out there. The younger one's out blowing his inheritance, and the older son's out in the field where he belongs. That's the way it's supposed to be. So that didn't surprise anybody. But, you know, how would you feel? I know. I only have one brother. There's only one brother in this story, right? I only had one brother, and I know how I would feel. I could probably, if I thought hard enough, I could think of examples in my life where I felt exactly this way because of something similar happening. Jesus is making this very real, I think, by painting a picture where people can see where they fit in the story. Where it might be a father, it might be an old, probably most of the people that we're hearing his parables were either older women who maybe could be free to get away from, you know, whatever their responsibilities were to listen to him, or younger men. Maybe the older men, maybe not so many. But that's my guess. But Jesus is making this real. He's painting a picture that everybody that's listening can say, yeah, I see. The son should think twice about going into that, you know? You got these feelings. You got these feelings because everybody knows where they fit. Put yourself in the older son's sandals, and that's not hard for me to do. Like I said, God's not like us. We have to change to become like him. The father in this story is doing things that maybe you would do, but I didn't. I didn't tend to be that way. So this is really effective storytelling. It's letting us hang a little bit, not giving us all the answers and letting us think, how does this work? How do we fit? What does this mean? That's a good story. I think Jesus had them sitting on the edge of their rock or whatever they were sitting on. So it says he became angry. He wasn't willing to go in. His father came out and pleaded with him. The answer said to his father, look, for so many years I've been serving you, I've never neglected a command of yours, and yet you have never given me a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends. He became angry. Now, if you've been listening to the story up to this part, you're sitting there on your rock, you know, you probably expect that this is the way it's going to work out. You don't think the son's going to be happy, because you don't think you would be happy, and you don't, you know, that's the story wouldn't be as interesting if the son said, oh, great, I'm glad he's back. And where do you go from there? Most of the parable, as you see, is about the older son and his reaction and his dealing with his father. I would say most, the largest portion, a plurality of the parable, I guess you could say. Not willing to go in. Well, we expect that. That's just the way it is. And when you think about it, now they weren't any Christians at this time, but this is written for us too, right? People that come along later. Are Christians always excited? I'm going ahead of myself here, sorry. Are Christians always excited when sinners repent? This is something Jesus was dealing with all the time with the Pharisees. Now, they were Jews. These are Jews, not Christians yet. But in the Christian world for 2,000 years, we have all kind. Sometimes people are happy that people repent. Sometimes you're not so happy. But these people that have been sinners all their lives, and they come along the last minute, and they're going to get the same reward. It's like the parable of the workers in the vineyard would get a penny whether they show up right before quitting time or been there all day working. That's just the way life is. And Jesus dealt with that several times. So, the laborers with a day's pay. His father is pleading with him, trying to make him see that there's another way you can look at this. He intercedes. He pleads with his son. Now, this isn't typically how Pharisees responded. We talked before about the parable when, the whole story, the whole account of when Jesus is at Simon's house and the woman comes and washes his feet and all that. And all of those people, Simon and the rest of the Pharisees there, if he knew what kind of a woman this was, he wouldn't be letting her touch him. That's the way they were. And Jesus' point is like, these are the people that need rescuing. That's who I'm sent to. And the Father, of course, most interpreters believe that the Father stands for the Father in heaven. The Father pleads with us to say, be happy that sinners are repenting and coming to me and coming to my son. Even if those sinners are, have been lived lousy lives that you can disapprove of. Or maybe they've hurt you personally, whatever. He says, you've never given me a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends. One scholar, I don't know what they know and how they know it, estimated the value of a goat at that time to be about a tenth of the value of that calf. I don't know, why. Maybe there's an old calf. Calves get a lot bigger eventually than goats do. Don't know. Whatever it is, the calf is worth more. So the son is not actually saying, you didn't ever give me a goat. He's saying, you never even gave me a goat. It's a, he's making something negative out of this. Not only are you giving him a calf, but you never even give me a goat. That's the least you could have done, but you didn't. He's in, I don't know how you spell it, he's in a tood. It's a T-O-O-D, T-U-D-E, I don't know. He's in a tood. And, Jesus is painting the picture this way on purpose, so we can see that he's in a tood. He's not going in there, he's not going to have anything to do with this whole thing. He's not happy. He's been the responsible firstborn all along and didn't even get a goat. The son wasted his inheritance and having a big party with all his friends with a calf. Not happy. And he continues. He's not done. Jesus is really laying it on here. It says, when this son of yours came who's devoured your wealth with prostitutes, you killed the fattened calf for him. And the father said, son, you've always been with me, and all that's mine is yours. But we had to celebrate and rejoice, for this brother of yours was dead and has begun to live, and he was lost and he's been found. That's the end. Notice these hurtful words that the son is really in a tune. He says, this son of yours. What's the problem with the son? Well, the son wasn't respectful. Is this respectful of the father? This son of yours. So what's the son doing? He's doing just like the Pharisees, isn't he? He's drawing lines. This guy, he's not my brother. He's your son. And you needed to be acting differently than you're acting, or whatever. He's critical. The Pharisees had the very exact rules, right? Of who belonged to the people of God and who didn't. And that's what this story is kind of pointing to. The son is saying, look, I've been here. I've been doing what you said all along. How in the world can you reach out to him when he's just spatting in your face? And you know what? The son's right. He has been there. The responsible firstborn and the younger son did spit in his father's face. So he's not wrong about the facts. He's wrong about how he approached it and how he reacted to it. How does the father respond? The father could, again, tell him off. But he doesn't. He says, we had to celebrate for this brother of yours. Now, whether Jesus told it exactly like this every time he told it, or Luke made sure he's, in this case he did. But isn't that neat? The son calls it, you're this son of yours. And this father reminds him, he's your brother. And you grew up together. You're part of the same family. And again, that applies, how does that apply to us? We're Christians, right? And a lot of times we want to draw a line. I'm going to talk about that in a minute. But anyway, the Father is all about reconciliation and relationship, as some of you already pointed out. In between those comments about the Father, your son and your brother, the Father says, son, you've always been with me, and all that is mine is yours. Isn't it enough to be a Christian? Or do we have to be the only true Christians? Or does everybody else have to be a so-called Christian? Or whatever it is in our culture, that we want to make ourselves special and draw a line between us and other people. And I'm not judging other people one way or the other. I'm just saying we want to be special. The son, the older son, wanted to be special. He wanted to be something different than his younger son. He wasn't real happy to be in the same class, if you want to put it that way, or the same thought, or the same box as his younger brother. In fact, he wasn't going to go into that party, because that would be admitting that we're brothers. It would be a whole lot of things, I guess. I think this parable makes it clear that there's plenty of fault to go around, so we need to look at ourselves. The son, the older son, this parable is not... It's about the younger son, but it seems to me it's more about the reaction of his older brother and his father trying to maintain good relationships or rebuild good relationships. There's a lot here. And then he ends up saying, we had to celebrate. We had to celebrate. That was the point made in the first two parables. When the lost are found, we celebrate. There's celebration in heaven. And it's interesting, he says, this brother of yours was dead, and it doesn't say now lives. It says he has begun to live. It's a process. We're happy that he started the journey. In other words, maybe giving a little bit of credence to this older son's point of view. Like, my brother's a loser. Well, he has been, but he's begun to live again. He's on the right path again. We need to celebrate that because it's good news. And we ought to think about the spiritual application there. That being found is a key to understanding all three of these parables. It's all about being found. And when a sinner is found, when we are found, that's worth celebrating. It ends with, we had to celebrate and rejoice, for this brother of yours was dead and has begun to live and was lost and has been found. That's the ending. There's no telling you what this means, what the people in heaven, what the beings in heaven think about this. It doesn't explain it. It makes you think. Now, who is this parable really about in the end? What can we take away from this? I think we can learn things from each of the three main characters. And I'm sure there are books full of, I could go on and on for hours, but I'm not going to. We have the prodigal son. What can we learn from his experience? Just shout them out if you got some ideas here. What can we learn from this experience of the son, the younger son? We've talked about some of it already. Well, I didn't write that down. Well, it's better not to learn the hard way. I'm a wimp at heart, I've probably told you this years ago, but I growing up in the church, especially as a young man with a family, I would pray to learn the easy way. I didn't want to suffer. I think, God, help me to learn the easy way. I mean, he did some things wrong. What can we learn from his bad experience? We need to learn. We talked about honor your family, honor your father. He asked for that money early, right? What can we learn from that? Didn't work out for him. Huh? Yeah, well, I think we learned to be patient. In fact, that's probably true of all three of them. What did he do when he came back to his father? What he said. He
humbled himself.
Yeah, he humbled himself. Yeah. Humbled himself. He admitted he was wrong. He admitted he'd had bad judgment. It's hard for us as human beings to admit that we were wrong. You're talking to an expert. I mean, you're looking at an expert here, and that. I hate to be wrong. And when I am, I can be defensive about it. Need to admit that. When he came back, now I've been around people in my life that are Christian and who expect me to overlook their faults because it's my obligation to be exhibiting grace. You ever run into people like that? Like, if for you to be gracious, you have to not be so critical of the fact that I'm hurting you right now. It's almost like they're pulling on your ear and saying, but you're supposed to be gracious, so this doesn't hurt. I've been around people like that. The son did not do that. He didn't demand grace. He didn't come back and say, I'm here and you got to overlook everything. I'm a different person now. He didn't do that. He didn't try to claim anything. But when grace was offered and generosity was offered, he accepted it. He said, well, I'm not worthy to be your son. But when his father said, no, we're not having any of that. You are my son. He didn't just say, well, nope, I'm out of here. He accepted the grace. Sometimes human beings, you may have seen people like that. You may be like that yourself. We tend to not accept grace or generosity. Somebody wants to bless them. We say, no, you can't do that. Let them bless you. Let them be generous. Let them be gracious to you. Let God be gracious to us. So sometimes we aren't like that as human beings. And we already talked about this, but coming home means coming to the Father. It's not enough to sit in the right pew. You have to have a relationship with the one who owns the church, if you want to put it that way. It's all about the relationship, not just going through the motions. Israel, again and again and again. The prophets complained about the nation of Israel. Why? Because they didn't have a relationship with God that they should have had with Yahweh. They did the rituals. They went, they had the sacrifices. They did that. Sometimes they were idolaters. But even when the prophets are complaining about people, like when Jeremiah stood there at the door of the temple, and he's telling people to, as they're coming in to do what God told them to do, do sacrifices and all, he's telling them they got to amend their ways, change the way you are. Because it's not enough to just do the commands. We have to have a relationship with the one we're doing them, who made the commands. We have to have that one-on-one relationship. And it's a wonderful thing that God offers that. Anything else about the prodigal son that comes to mind? Let's talk about the older son. What can you learn from him? Maybe a bunch of things. I have my own list, but I know, in my case, I tend to be confronted with some kind of a circumstance, and I have an initial reaction to that. And that's not always the best reaction. Does anybody relate to that? We're angry about something. We think this is wrong, or it shouldn't be this way. I tend to open my mouth when that happens, spout off about something. I think one of the things we can learn from this son is that, he had this initial reaction. He's already got in his mind about his brother, what he thinks. And so when he hears he's home and he's having a big party, his initial reaction is all negative. And what I can learn from this, because I tend to be the same way, is don't trust that reaction. I gotta let that go. I got to let that go and look at it more like the father looked at it. In this story, he wouldn't let that go. Because he had a grudge here for however long it had been. He was upset with his brother, and he was upset at his father for giving in to his brother, giving him the money and all that in the first place. He was upset with everybody, and he couldn't let it go. Another thing that Christians that we're asked to do, I think, in the Bible and in this parable, that's hard, is to be gracious to those who don't deserve it. The father is asking the older son, pleading with him, it says, to be gracious, come into the party, welcome your brother home. The father does not claim in any way in this story that the son, the younger son, deserved a nice welcome, that he deserved to have his brother come in and welcome him. He just said, just do it. The father, you know, just do it. It's the right thing to do. It's a hard thing to do, though, sometimes. It's easier to hold grudges and be upset than it is to be gracious, give grace to people who don't deserve it. In fact, that's the whole meaning of the word grace, is you're nice to people who don't deserve it. But that's what Christians are called on to do and have been doing for thousands of years. Then the father says, you know, you've been with, everything I have is yours. He tries to win him over. What's he saying? He's saying, look, you're my son. That's good enough. What more do you need or want? You are going to inherit everything. Isn't that enough? You know, don't compare yourselves among yourselves. You read that in 2 Corinthians 10 and verse 12. It's not wise to just get into this comparison mode. We're kind of in that in our country now, that we have this mentality, not maybe the whole world, but in our country, where in order for me to win, you have to lose. Why can't we both win? This zero-sum approach. The son here, it's like, I don't even get a goat. How does he get the fattened calf? You know, this, my brother has done a bunch of bad things. He needs to suffer for it. The only way I can be blessed is if he's hurt. That's not godly. And we have different constituencies in our own country that feel that way. And it's going to be our doom if we don't get over it. You know, you can't always have the approach that in order for me to be successful in what I do, somebody else has to be unsuccessful. Shouldn't work that way. But that's the way the older son was. We can't be gracious to him. I can't feel good about it if he has to be in the family's good graces again after what he's done. He needs to lose somehow. If you're familiar with Shakespeare, it's like Merchant of Venice. I got to have my pound of flesh, Shylock. I need a pound of flesh. I need to make sure he's hurting. All right, how about the father? What can we learn from the father? I think one thing is that the best thing to do is not always the normal thing to do, or what people expect you to do, or what is the culture expects you to do. Sometimes you have to do something different. You got to think outside the box. God's willing to think outside the box. In fact, I think the book of Job makes it clear that sometimes God thinks out of his own box, in a sense, that what we think his box is. God can't do this and this and this because he says this and this. And God's telling Job, you know, I can do whatever I want to. Because I'm God, you're not. End of story. Sometimes the best thing to do is not what everybody thinks you're going to do or what you think that the Bible says, you know, whatever. I mean, we all have our own interpretations. But the father in this story does some things that are kind of like, why'd he do that? Well, that was the thing he needed to do. And sometimes he didn't have a whole lot of support when he did it. He was patient. He didn't go out and try to bring his son back and make his son knuckle down or whatever. That's really hard to do, at least for some of us, I can say in my case. When I make it right now, God's very patient, isn't he, with all of us. And the father was very patient with both of his sons. He didn't make the younger son not leave. He didn't make the older son go into the party. He's kind of letting people, in a sense, makes their own choices and decisions here. The father was patient. He was gracious. He was forgiving. That's always not easy. He didn't keep score. He didn't say, all right, you owe me when the son came back. I told you before, I was always like a scorekeeper. That's the problem with being a math and science guy and also having relationships with people. It's like you tend to keep score because that's what you do. I have two grandchildren. One of them is actually the one that's the math science one. It isn't the one that likes to keep score. It's the other one. But anyway, it's normal for kids to do that. But we got to grow out of that. And we also have to understand, and this is not easy either, that other people will not always understand our motivation. You know, when the father did some things in this story that were out of the ordinary, he had to withstand at least implied criticism. It's just a story, so there's nobody criticizing in the story. But even the people that are hearing the story are thinking, what's he doing that for? But the most interesting thing of all of this with the father, I think, and this is where I'm going to stop. Very interesting that the father allows the others in this story, his two sons, to write their own endings. Doesn't give us the ending. Jesus didn't give us the ending. Luke didn't give us the ending. We don't know whether the son went into the party or not. But we have to think about it and think about what we would do and how we would respond.